The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
The future may not be clear, but our commitment is. So when you sit with an advisor at Merrill Lynch, we'll put your interests first. Visit ml.com and learn more about Merrill Lynch, an affiliate of Bank of America. Merrill Lynch makes available products and services offered by Merrill Lynch, Pierce Fenner & Smith Incorporated, a registered broker-dealer member, SIPC.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week on the podcast, we have an extra special guest. His name is Ned Davis. He is the founder of the highly regarded Ned Davis Research and author of numerous books. We'll talk about that later. Quick, interesting story. Long before Masters in Business came along, I had been kicking an idea around about finding these really successful, articulate, intelligent people and sitting down and having a conversation with them. And I think Ned... I'll include the link to this on the blog post. Ned may have been the very first person I spoke to. We did it on the radio. We did it unedited. It was pretty much straight through. It's very rough. But the concept for this show pretty much came from a conversation I had with him. He is one of the best regarded technicians around, a technician's technician. If you are at all interested in quantitative technical trading, you're going to love this. So with no further ado, my conversation with Ned Davis. My special guest today is Ned Davis. He is the founder of renowned technical research firm, Ned Davis Research. Ned was a regular on This Week with Louis Rukeyser. He frequently graces the pages of Barron's and other financial publications. He founded Ned Davis Research in 1980. It now employs well over 100 people. He is the author of The Triumph of Contrarian Investing, Markets in Motion, and Being Right or Making Money. And he's probably best known as a technician's technician. Ned Davis, welcome to Bloomberg.
Thank you for having me.
You know, it's really interesting that we have you here, because when I first started doing this before we were broadcasting them on the radio, you were one of the first people I spoke with, and we did a phone interview. I want to say that was like 8 or 10 years ago. A lot of stuff has happened since then. Let's talk a little bit about your background. You were studying French in, I believe it was Paris, when you decided, I'm going to change my career direction. Tell us about that incident.
Well, actually, I was at the University of North Carolina, and I had decided I wanted to be a doctor, and so I was a chemistry major, and then I decided I did not want to be a doctor, and I was spending a part of a year in France, and so I had to graduate with something else, and I really liked French literature, so that's the way I graduated as a French major. I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do, so they have these, I guess, psychological tests that test your aptitude and your interests, and they said my aptitude was in math, but I wasn't interested in math, and what I was interested in was verbal, but I wasn't any good at verbal, so I was thinking I had two jobs in the summer at a company called J.C. Bradford & Company as an intern, and I really liked that. You were able to write and read and write, and you're able to use your math skills. So I said, well, this is perfect for me. So then I ended up going to Harvard Business School, which I thought I was going to learn business, but it's actually a management school, which is not what I wanted. So then I went to work full-time for J.C. Bradford & Company.
So somewhere in the middle of that, I recall you telling a story about studying French in France. Someone made a reference about your Southern accent, and you were kind of thinking, really, I'm not sure if this is for me. Am I misremembering that?
Well, I really did not know much French when when I went to France, and you know, I was trying to learn the languages best I could, and we had a class, and the teacher said, "Oh, thank you for saying that." This was in French, of course. And she said, "I always wondered what Lyndon Johnson would sound like speaking French, and now I know." And I'm thinking, well, Lyndon Johnson can barely speak English much. So I decided that speaking French was not going to be my skill set.
So you go to J.C. Bradford. You start penning a daily technical report. What were your go-to indicators or charts back at that time?
I think I was pretty much a traditional chartist at that time, and just looking at chart patterns and trying to pick out stocks in uptrends and stay away from stocks in downtrends. But of course, I was studying a lot of other, I'd say, independent research at the time. So I was trying to learn from that. So I pretty much I've self-taught myself my field.
What was it like really beginning your education in the field in what turned out to be a pretty long bear market in the 60s and 70s?
Yeah, I think that makes a big difference when you ask people what your outlook is on the market. And I say, well, when did you start in the business? And if you started in 68, like I did, you were going to live the first 14 years in a really grueling bear market.
So a quote of yours goes something like this: We are in the business of making mistakes. The only difference between the winners and the losers is that the winners make small mistakes while the losers make big mistakes. Discuss that a bit.
The whole Warren Buffett's got a quote, and he says two rules for making money. And he said, rule number one, don't lose money. And he said, rule number two, never forget rule number one. So it's all about compounding interest and compounding your returns. And if you take a horrible loss, if you lose 50% on a stock, it's not a 50% rise that gets you back to even. It's a 100% rise. So if you have a big loss, it's really hard to compound your returns. So I knew there was going to be mistakes in the business. I'm just trying to, find out a mistake and cut it as quickly as possible. I think that's the key.
And early in your career, you had made a number of calls, some of which were very big calls, but I have been following your career and reading you for so long. I know your thinking on predictions and forecasting has evolved a lot. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, it's a business of forecasting. That's what clients want you to do. So that's what I tried to do. And I studied forecasts, and I saw a lot of forecasters make some dramatically correct forecasts. But generally, they would make a great forecast and a couple of years later make a terrible forecast. And it was just like a flame out in the night. And I didn't want my career to be that way. And I was lucky enough to have some really good forecasts, but I still was suspicious. And when you go back and study the forecasting record, for example, the Federal Reserve Board of Philadelphia has been studying for 50 years a consensus of professional economists, and they look at their forecast for the following year. There's been seven recessions since 1970, and the economists as a group, obviously individual economists have done better, but as a group, they call none, not a single one of the seven recessions. And interestingly enough, in the last, since 2001, they've been 86% of the time they've been too low on their forecasts. The forecasts have been too high for what the economy's actually done. So it's a very tough field, forecasting.
You launched your firm in 1980. Really, a couple of recessions, a long bear market. That must have been a really challenging time to launch a new services firm.
Well, actually, we sell ourselves as risk managers, and it had been such a long period of high risk that people were looking around for risk managers. And it just so happened after that period, long period of time, 68 to 80, most of the time I was with J.C. Bradford. And of course, retail brokerage firms are historically bullish and should be. But most of the time that I was there, I was negative. And it was just about the 1980 early period that I was turning more bullish on the long-term outlook. So that was a very fortunate thing. And so I left there. I was a partner at Bradford's, but I wanted to, I guess my contribution to the business is that this was really before computers had taken over. In fact, they had just started over taking over the back offices. And so I wanted to make the research that I do computerized so that I could test some of these things that that people saw on charts and see if any of them worked.
So you got a lot of pushback from Bradford saying, hey, I really think we should adapt the new technology to our practice. They weren't very keen on that.
Well, the answer basically was if it ain't broke, don't fix it, which is a good answer. But this is something I wanted to do. And there were a couple Bradford brokers, Ed Mendel and Kent Regenstein, that wanted to go out and try this. And we already had a pretty good following. So we were nervous about it, obviously, but we didn't use any debt. We put up our own money, and you know, we had enough customers, and we made a go of it from the beginning.
Launching with a handful of customers or a decent number of customers, how to make that transition fairly even? What were the first fairly easy? What were the first couple of years like when you were building the business?
Well, you know, it was. I'm not a manager. I'm a research nerd, and that's what I like to do. So Eddie and Kent were in Atlanta, Georgia, which is
Eddie Mendel and Kent
Regenstein, and mm-hmm. they were in Atlanta, which is where the sales were, and I was in just outside of Sarasota, Florida, where I lived. And so anyway, I had to put together some people, and it was fun being a starting manager. Is not something that I like doing, but it was fun.
So after a few years, you developed quite a reputation. And one of the things Ned Davis Research was known for was these specific research projects requested by clients. In fact, recently they were doing more than 2,000 client-generated research projects a year. How did that approach develop, and how do people approach you with, hey, I have an idea I want to test out?
Well, once we built our own software and had the computers around, you know, my idea actually was building a company similar to what ValueLine had built in the fundamental research area. Mm-hmm. And I remember specifically the date that Arnold Bernhardt died, because ValueLine stock went up big that day. And I thought, this is the kind of firm you want to build, that people want your data, they want your charts, they want your studies. They don't necessarily looking for, you know, a guru that walks on water. So I decided to try to build a company like that. So yes, we set up a client services department where we would say, you have research questions, you bring them here, and we'll do the research for you. And we won't share the research with our own research team. It's your proprietary product. And it's been a good product for us. And we've come up actually, you know, I don't know, I've come up with a lot of ideas on my own, but we say we're client driven, and some of the best ideas I've had were client ideas.
Give us an example of some typical client requests or some unusual client requests.
Well, you know, a lot of times that we'll have a chart and they'll want to see it back further, or they'll want to see a different version of it. You know, we had a lot of crisis events when I got into the business, and people said, what did the market do after there's a major crisis event? So we went back and, you know, we tried to study history, and, you know, there was Pearl Harbor and there was JFK's assassination. I got in the business, you know, Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy died assassinated the first year. And then you had Penn Central and on and on. So we put all this together and saw what the market did. And it was fascinating. Generally, there was a sell-off, as you would expect on the news, but very short term. And almost, you know, 6 months to a year later, the market was almost always higher. So we had put this study together, and we had shown it a couple times in publications. And then on 9/11, we got a call from, we put it out again, and we got a call from Barron's, and they wanted to use it. And, you know, it, as terrible as that tragedy was, the study was very timely in that, you know, there was a weak sell-off, and it was a very scary time. But the market did recover after that pretty well.
So in response to unexpected geopolitical events, markets wobble and then go about resuming their prior trends.
Exactly. Sometimes, you know, they do better. It's the logic's a little difficult to understand. But if you're a nervous holder of stock and some bad news comes, you panic out. And then who's left are strong holders of stock. So, you know, it's at that point, it's hard to get people to sell after you've gotten the nervous people out. You got good strong holders of stock.
Counterintuitive, but you get a washout, and then you're only left with people who are not likely to jump out at any given moment.
The exception to this, of course, and there are not many, but the exception was Lehman, which was a panic event that was systemic. And I think that that is a key when you're looking at crisis events. If it's going to take down the financial system, then the study's not going to work. But pretty much anything else, wars, bombings, terror attacks, you know, the worst things you can think of, assassination of a president, these things pretty much all fit the same pattern.
Even Lehman Brothers was September 08. Markets had peaked October 07, so it had been practically a year of downtrend. The only real difference between the trend is Lehman just precipitated an acceleration to the downside.
That's partly true, but I think the systemic part to the banking system is critical.
Let's talk a little bit about technical analysis. So you were an early adopter, not only of technical analysis, but of technology as well. Tell us how that changed the way you looked at markets.
Well, you know, you start off, you read Edwards and McGee, a technical analysis book, or a lot of other really well-written books on chart patterns. And then you start applying that, and you see a head and shoulders bottom, and you say, oh my goodness, this stock is turning up. And then you're reading another report, and somebody's looking at the same chart, and they say, "Oh no, that's a head and shoulders top," and it was almost like you made your own reality. You looked at a chart and you saw what you wanted to see. So I said, "I can't do this. I have to have it more quantitative. I've got to test these things and see whether they work or not." So that was the idea, really, of going to technology. I also, at that point, had gotten interested in other people that seemed very successful in the business. One of my mentors was a guy named Edson Gould, and he was a technician, but he also really believed that the stock market and the economy were driven by crowd psychology, and he was also a studier of the Federal Reserve Board. I also became good friends with Marty Zweig. He started out as a sentiment guy, too, and he ended up, like me, don't fight the Fed, don't fight the tape. So
Marty Zweig is always my answer to the question, how come there are no rich technicians? And the answer is there are a ton of very successful people who use technicals as a fundamental basis of their trading and their investment strategy. Did you get a lot of pushback from your work from the fundamental community?
I think originally there were only a handful, Alan Shaw, Bob Farrell, there were really only a handful of technicians that that were in high regard. And so it was difficult at first. But, you know, again, once you go through a bear market, people look around and say, you know, I can't just buy and hold all the time without concern over anything. I have to, you know, manage my risks. And so it's gotten obviously a lot more popular.
How did technicals differ at the institutional level and the retail level?
Well, I think retail was, you know, more interested in just, you know, short-term movements in stocks. And the institutionals were more interested in a big picture, maybe tying it in with the macro and the Fed and sentiment and longer-term things. And I had also gotten interested, you know, in the Federal Reserve Board's you know, emphasis on in the stock market. And so trying to put things in perspective, a guy named Hamilton Bolton with the bank credit analyst had put together a monetary thermometer, which was really a one of the first models that they had, timing model using Federal Reserve statistics. And I was really fascinated by that.
So these days, there's a near infinite amount of charting software. You could pretty much access a ton of really highly detailed technical studies, some of which are free, some of which are fairly modestly priced. What has the ubiquity of computing power and all the software done to the world of trading and investing?
Well, it's a good question, and the answer is complicated. There's a lot of good ideas. You know, this happens to be one that fits my psyche on how to invest, but there's a lot of good ideas about how to invest and how to make money. The one key problem is if something gets too popular, it's going to hurt its effectiveness. So, but this is true of anything. I remember in the 1980s, which was a big period because it was the start of my company, and it was a bull market period, and people didn't need risk advisors for a while, and we got into 1987, and I got really worried about derivatives and what they could do to the market. But anyway,
are you referring to portfolio insurance or something broader than that?
Portfolio insurance, which was part of using derivatives to do portfolio insurance. And actually, I thought portfolio insurance was one of the coolest ideas I'd ever heard of. And it actually fit exactly what I want to do with my hedge work. I want to protect my portfolio in a downtrend. And so it was a great idea, and it was widely sold on Wall Street. And then, the market started down, and fortunately I was able to sort of see this one. So anyway, that we had a crash that I think was caused really by a great idea that got too popular. So this is the thing: when technical analysis gets so popular, everybody's looking at the same patterns and the same breakouts and acting on them, it's not going to act as well as if you could find something that nobody's looking at.
Let's talk a little bit about the stock market and what separates good investors from not so good investors. You wrote something not too long ago in one of your books, or maybe it was a little while ago. Good investors, successful investors have four basic traits. They're objective, they're disciplined, they're flexible, and they're risk averse. Is it that simple? It's just those four things. You do that and you're good to be a good investor?
Yes, it's complicated when you say those things together because people think, well, discipline is the opposite of flexible. But when we use the term flexible, we're really thinking about open-mindedness. And this is one of the curses in my life, or one of the gifts in my life, is that if there's a debate, I could pretty well take both sides and do a pretty good job.
So that means you're objective.
I have a gift of being able to see both sides. The negative is it's hard to be 100% black or white when you can see the world's actually gray.
What about risk averse? Because we're taught that risk aversion often leads people to be too quick to jump out of equities when they should be a little more risk embracing.
Yes, well, that's a good question because it happens to be the one piece of my philosophy that has changed over the years, because there's a lot of risk takers that have made a lot of money, but what they do is they manage their risk. So they'll take a big position, but if it goes sour or the news changes, they get out. So it's still a matter of risk management. But I think the term risk averse was came from being in the market from 1968 to 82, frankly.
So speaking of which, those who study history are condemned to repeat its mistakes. How difficult is it for investors to learn the lessons that history presents to us?
Well, it's tricky because you want to learn the correct lessons and you don't want to learn the bad lessons. And it's a little hard to know which it is. So what happens is there'll be a period of time and there was a mistake during that period of time and everybody learns and says, well, I won't make that mistake again. And then times change and periods change and eras change. And everybody's learned the lesson of that period, but not the next period. So, again, I think the real lesson is studying studying history is seeing manias, bubbles, seeing, you know, extremes from extreme pessimism to extreme optimism, and how these end up, how they end up. And that's the lesson. It's not just portfolio insurance is something I'll never do again. That's not really the lesson. The lesson is it got too popular. The market got too high. There was too much optimism, and that is a terrible combination. That's the lesson to learn.
So between the extremes of too much pessimism, like we saw in 87 and 73, 74 and 03 and 09, and too much optimism with 66, and go through the list, 66 and 2000, and then again in 07, although I don't know if that was as much too much optimism as you mentioned, a systemic problem. Where are we in that spectrum between too much negativity and too much enthusiasm?
Yeah, so I think it was Templeton that said, bull markets are born in pessimism, they rise on skepticism, they mature on optimism, and they die on euphoria. And I think that's pretty much what we've seen since 2009. We've gone through those phases. And I think after the election, for whatever reason, we went into the euphoric stage. And you can see this in all kinds of consumer confidence, business confidence, CEO confidence. So
all the soft sentiment data got way, way higher than it was
euphoric
previously.
But we just this is an early phase of euphoria, so I don't necessarily think this is the end, but I think you can certainly see euphoria, and that's a high risk phase.
So what should investors do to manage their risk? What's the best approach for someone's listening to this? They have a couple of $1 million in their 401k and their investment portfolios. How should they manage that?
Well, you know, as a, if you're a chartist and that's your background, you can see formations, you see demand on a chart, or you see trend lines, and or you just use stop losses below important lows. And if the market turns down, you just get stopped out. Other people might want to right now the protection, the insurance, portfolio insurance for portfolios, the VIX. Is very low. VIX is how much it costs to buy options. The VIX is very low. You can buy some puts to protect your portfolio. Some hedge fund short stocks. You can put some money in cash and wait for pullbacks. So there's lots of things you can do.
So is an interesting question that comes up with the rise of technical analysis, which is thanks to computers, we could pretty much put anything on a chart. How advisable is it to chart everything you possibly can? You could look at earnings. You could look at everything from GDP to what have you. There really isn't any data series that can't be put on a chart.
No, and that's what we do. I mean, that's what my business does pretty much. And we actually analyze the economy pretty much the same way we do the stock market. We use sentiment indicators. We use trend indicators. In the economy, there's a lot of indicators that tend to lead the economy. So we put most of our emphasis on the leading economic indicators. And when they're turning up and are strong, then that's a good sign. So I do this somewhat in the stock market. There's certain groups and sectors that tend to lead the market. And so we put our main emphasis on those, the trend of those. Also, we look for the economy or the stock market. We look for the Federal Reserve Board and what are they doing, because they control the cost of money and the availability of money. And if you're looking at supply and demand, which is what technical analysis is all about, how can you ignore the Federal Reserve Board? You really can't.
Talk to me about Big Mo. It's one of my favorite charts of yours. How did the idea come about, and what? Tell us what it actually depicts.
Okay, Big Mo is just the trend of 100 industry groups, 100 sub-industry groups, and it's the cyclical trend. So we're talking, you know, a year or two kind of trends. But I called it, put the Mo in there. We also look at rates of change, how fast a group is rising or falling, and the momentum indicators are trend sensitive, but they're not exactly trend indicators. So they can be early. So when you put the trend following indicators and the The momentum indicators together, I think you can get a little closer to tops and bottoms. And Big Mo right now shows about 69% of those industry groups are still in strong uptrends. And that's a decent figure. It's a high neutral, I would say, mildly bullish. And we use below 56% as a warning sign.
So you mentioned the rise in sentiment indicators earlier. Someone did a study not too long ago that showed the largest gap ever between soft survey sentiment information and hard actual data. What do you think of that gap between the two?
Well, I think clearly the soft tends to be leads the hard. So the fact that the soft is strong and the hard is weak is not necessarily a bad sign. However, this works much better depending on where you are in a cycle. If you're coming out of a recession and there's a lot of unused labor, unused capital, there's a lot of savings around, and then sentiment soars, well, people have the ability to go out and spend. And we saw this in 2009, 2010. Now, we're getting the same kind of sentiment readings now, but we've had 9 years of an expansion, and people have very little savings. They're up to their teeth. You got over $1 trillion in student debt. You know, I got $1 trillion of credit card debt, and you got $1 trillion in auto debt. So it's a lot different thing. So yes, I think the hard data is going to come on, but not by much.
So since we're talking about sentiment, how noisy is the series of sentiment data? It seems that there's a lot of fairly wild swings over short periods of time.
Well, it just depends on who your, you know, what your survey is. If it's futures traders, they're going to be pretty quick. CEOs don't change their opinion that often. So it depends. But there are small surveys. And if Trump proved anything, he proved that, you know, that polls aren't always right. So what we do, we look at a lot of polls. We also look at what people are doing in terms of option trading, how optimistic people are, upside volume versus downside volume, a lot of measures of activity. And we put all these together in a composite model. I think one of the ones we use has 28 indicators in it. So if some of them are fake news, then you hope the majority picks up the correct picture.
What's the name of that particular chart or indicator?
Well, we have the NDR crowd sentiment poll.
We have been speaking with Ned Davis, co-founder of Ned Davis Research. If you enjoy this conversation, be sure and stick around for the podcast extras, where we keep the digital tape rolling and continue to talk about all things technical. Be sure and check out my daily column at BloombergView.com. Follow me on Twitter at Ritholtz. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You're listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
What could your future hold? More than you think. Because at Merrill Lynch, we work with you to create a strategy built around your priorities. Visit ml.com and learn more about Merrill Lynch, an affiliate of Bank of America. Merrill Lynch makes available products and services offered by Merrill Lynch, Pierce Fenner & Smith Incorporated, a registered broker-dealer member, SIPC.
Welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much, Ned, for doing this. I have to share the funny story. When I first started writing for Bloomberg about 3 or 4 years ago, they came to me and said, what would you like to do? And there was a whole long story. And the takeaway was, I want to sit down with accomplished, intelligent people and have a conversation about their career and their impact on markets and business and what have you. You were one of, if not the first interview I had done. And so I said, like this Ned Davis interview, here's a SoundCloud embed, take a look at it. And in hindsight, it's very rough, it's on the phone. The reference from Malcolm Gladwell in Outliers, you do something for 10,000 hours, you eventually get good at it. I haven't quite done a full 10,000 hours, but you're about 150-something. We've been doing this now for 3 years. And when I listened to that interview in preparation for this interview, I have to say you were very patient and very kind because I was just god awful then. But I really appreciate you coming back and letting a somewhat improved version of me have this conversation. So thank you very much for flying up for this. I've been a fan of your work for forever. We didn't get to talk about the books during the broadcast portion, but I have to ask you a few questions about these because these are really very significant books in the world of investing. The first one that I have to talk about is this one, Being Right or Making Money. Now a collector's edition, you can't find that. I've had this for I don't know how long, underlined and highlighted. What was the thinking behind writing that book?
Well, again, I was, you know, trying to outline my philosophy mainly for clients, but that spending time on trying to forecast and be right is interesting. I certainly continue to do that, but really the focus should be on how to make money. And so, and again, we use the tape, the trend, the sentiment, and the Federal Reserve Board to make money. But I think the one of the big things is, as I mentioned it earlier, is the magic of compound interest. And this is just a simple math thing that every kid should learn in school. But again, if you have a drawdown like 29 to 32 in stocks was 84%, you have to go up 525% to get back to even. And it took many, many years. So, we didn't want big drawdowns. That's the key to making money.
And one of the things that I've been thinking about since I read this book so long ago was when people make forecasts, there's a tendency to marry those forecasts, meaning despite evidence coming their way that they're wrong, they stick with the forecast regardless and don't adjust their portfolio appropriately. In other words, they're willing to lose money in order to hang around long enough for their forecast to eventually come true. How dangerous is that?
Well, you know, we have another expression that we like to use in my shop is we all make our own reality. And this was shocking the first time I heard it because I figured reality's reality. But sometimes when I'll be before an audience, I'll say, how many of you are sports fans? Let's say, are you Knicks fans? And I'm in New York, and they'll say yes. And I'll say, well, how many of you have ever gone to a game and thought the referee favored the other team? And, of course, nobody raises their hand because we see what we want to see. You know, we want the Knicks or whoever our team is to win. So we always go to the game and think the referees were for the other team. When the NBA's actually done studies that show, if anything, it's very slight, but there is a small favor. There's a small advantage for the home team in the calls in an average game. So this is something we see with our own eyes. So it's very easy. You have a position, you want it to work. You tend to read things that confirm your opinion and you don't read things that may not. So this again goes back to that flexibility thing. This is important. Or even just say, hey, I'm going to put a stop loss there. If I made a mistake, I made a mistake. I'm done.
The sports metaphor is so perfect. I'm a basketball fan. I'm a Knicks fan. And of course, Patrick Ewing would never got the call, but Shaq and Jordan always did. I'm not a big college basketball fan, but Joe Besseker of Emerald Asset Management is a huge fan. And during the NIT, I think it was the finals that are played at the Garden, I get a call one day, hey, I got courtside seats. You want to come see this? I go, I'm not a basketball fan. I'm not a college hoops fan. He goes, if you've never watched the game in the Garden courtside, you have to come see this. Okay, so we go watch this really exciting game, pretty close, only he's a fan of his alma mater, who actually made it, and I'm watching the game, and Joe is just distraught because every call is absolutely the worst call ever made to mankind, and ref, come on, the guy took six steps, he's walking. I have no dog in the fight. I could care less, and I'm like, hey, Joe, that was a step and a half. It's a layup. You're allowed to. And it was a moment of clarity that, oh, your subjectivity really affects the way you perceive the wall. It was amazing going to a game where you didn't care who won and watching people's reaction.
Yes, I think it was Extraordinary Popular Madness and Crowds. McKay wrote it, and he said an individual taken by themselves is rational. When you put the individual in a crowd, it becomes a blockhead. it's just totally crowd psychology is really, really strong. It's overwhelming. It takes all of us over. And it's really a very different than an individual psychology.
So another book I wanted to ask you about was The Triumph of Contrarian Investing, Crowds, Manias, and Beating the Market by Going Against the Grain. So a question I always have about contrarian investing is, well, markets have a tendency to go up over the long haul, and we have a tendency to see these long trends. Can you be a contrarian in the midst of a 10 or a 20-year bull market?
Yes. Well, that we like to say we go with the flow. In other words, we go with the crowd until they reach an extreme and begin to reverse. And it's at that small moment of time where it pays to be a contrarian. So it's a bad mistake to say, I'm just going to go against the crowd. That will not get you anywhere. You've got to really wait for extremes.
And a question I didn't get to during the broadcast portion was about competitors. You launched in 1980. Were there any real technicians doing the sort of work you were doing then? Who were your competitors as a research firm?
I don't think there were really any competitors doing technical research. I mentioned earlier Hamilton Bolton of the Bank Credit Analyst. They did a little bit of technical, a lot of monetary, and certainly they're one of our competitors. I'd like to compete with ISI, Ed Hyman, because he's just a champion. There's now Cornerstone Macro Research. There's RENMAC. Jeff DeGraff's a friend of mine. So I would say those all now have a technical element to them.
Mm-hmm. So it's broadened out. Given the change in the commission structure that's out there and the shrinking of institutional sales desks, is this end of the industry getting smaller and less competitive, or is it just consolidating with the handful of firms that seems to have figured out how to add value to the process?
It was concentrated by Wall Street banks, and now there's a lot of independent firms that are doing a great job. So I don't know. It has changed. Certainly commissions have changed. They were fixed when I got into the business. So it's gotten harder, but the business has changed. It's always changing.
So let's talk a little. It's always changing. That's pretty sage advice. Let's talk about the rise of quantitative and indexing. What does the rise of low-cost passive indexing mean to the world of active investing, and what does that mean to a firm that sells its research to money managers?
Well, if everybody's an active manager and they're competing with each other, then
it's a zero-sum game.
It's going to be it's going to be very difficult to beat the averages. So they're charging high fees to be active managers, and some of them are very successful. But on average, they're not doing any better than the market averages. So I think John Bogle had a great idea that to put these index together and low fees, and this would be a better investment for most people over the long run. And I think that's true. However, I noticed today, I just happened to see a Bloomberg thing where there was a chart and they said there's more index funds now than there are stocks. And so again, this is a popular idea. It's a good idea. There's nothing wrong with it. But if it gets too popular, it will blow up just like all the other big ideas do.
When does this get too popular? What do we? Vanguard is $4 trillion, $3 trillion of which is passive. BlackRock is $5 trillion. Most of that is passive. At what point, or much of that, I should say, is passive? At what point does this get to be too big?
Well, after Al Gore invented the internet, and we had all the .com stocks, I thought, gosh, this has got to be a bubble, certainly. And of course, it continued for a number of years, and it's even bigger today. So I think you can't just say it's extremely popular. You have to wait till the trends give up a little bit. You have to wait till the Fed becomes a little more hostile. And at that point, I think you make the bet passive investing is done. And I think it's a late phase.
Late phase. Okay, good.
Nothing wrong with passive investing. Nothing mm-hmm. wrong with portfolio insurance. There's nothing wrong with growth stocks. It's just when they get too popular.
And we're still not there yet, you're saying?
We're getting there.
We're getting there. Okay. So, which raises the question, and you've written about this a lot, is the role of emotions in investing. How important is it to keep emotions out? And then second, what can an investor do to maintain that?
Yes, well, that's why we put together these sentiment composites. And they asked Warren Buffett one time the secret of success. And, you know, he's a fundamental individual value investor. And he said, our secret is we try to buy when everybody's fearful and we try to sell when everybody is greedy.
Which is not a fundamental thing at all.
In fact, to me, it's a very technical thing mm-hmm. because when everybody's optimistic, they've already bought. And right. So who's left to buy? And when everybody's pessimistic, again, you run off all the nervous sellers. So you've got strong sellers of stock. So that's the idea. It's actually the same thing that Buffett did. We try to put these sentiment polls together to see when there's fear and greed, and we try to tell ourselves, I know the news is terrible, but you know sometimes clouds part, and it's a good time to buy. And by the way, our poll got very, very cautious before the election, and Mark's done pretty well since before the election.
So you're really essentially saying Warren Buffett is a closet technician? Is that what I'm hearing?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
And John Templeton, I mentioned earlier, he was also supposed to be a fundamentalist, and he described the market. Buffett said that really struck home with me. He said, it's not that I like pessimism. I just like the values that pessimism produces. So there you've put together now fundamentals, which are values, and you've put together sentiment, which I think is technical. So you do. When there's a lot of pessimism, you tend to get better values. And when there's a lot of euphoria, you tend to get an overvalued market. So it's really there's not really a struggle here in the long run between a technician and a fundamentalist.
All right, so let's shift over to my 10 favorite questions. I ask these of all my guests. Tell us about the most important thing people don't know about your background.
They probably don't know that I speak French.
Do you still speak French? Have you been
in Paris
recently?
I do not speak French, no.
So what don't they know about you? You once spoke French, but pretty much that's faded.
You know, I'm really very persistent in my work. I've been doing this for 50 years. I'm very focused on my work, but I try to have some balance in my life. And I have 4 kids and 2 grandkids, and I don't know exactly what role I had except being there. But I'm very proud of them. So I think that gives my life some balance.
Tell us about some of your early mentors.
Well, I mentioned Hamilton Bolton. I mentioned Edson Gould, who were two really outstanding pioneers. A guy named Marty Zweig I talked about, and sure. we did some research in conjunction with each other. Norman Fosbach, another guy that did a lot of to try to put technicals into studies and test them historically.
Stock
Market Logic was the name of his book.
I recall that.
And
who
right
else?
Now, the people still doing technical analysis that I do, like I do successfully, Jim Stack, who's Investec.
Sure.
And there's a guy, Dan Sullivan, who does the Chartis service that has a real-time track record that's terrific. And so
you mentioned Jeff DeGraff earlier.
Jeff DeGraff.
Any other technicians? We've spoken to Jeff DeGraff. We've spoken to John Roque. Who else do you think is an interesting technician?
You know, I really read a lot. I try not to again, it's the thing about being at the game, the crowd psychology. I try to let my charts talk to me, and so I try not to read too many competitors' work.
So you mentioned a number of people who influenced your approach to technical analysis. Any other technicians that were formative to you in your early days?
I really like Bob Farrell and Merrill Lynch. He, you know, Bob Farrell had an opinion, but he would give both sides. He would give a balanced view and sort of lean one way or the other. And that really appealed to me. I just did not like the approach that the world's all black or all white. It's 100% bullish or, you know, sell everything. I just don't think the world worked that way. And he was able to pull it off, and he had a lot of good rules. And
the 10 rules of market investing by Bob Farrell.
And they're excellent.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned Alan Shaw earlier, who some people, I believe he was the co-founder of the Market Technicians Association.
Right.
And very much an influential technical analyst. What's your relationship with Alan?
I know him, and I used to, you know, I used to read his work. And again, he's a level-headed, and he's a nice guy. He's an honest guy, and he helped a lot of people in the business that got into it and taught them stuff. And so
let's talk a little bit about books. What you mentioned, Edwards and McGee.
Edwards and McGee, yes, and Charles McKay had the Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowd. There's been some other books written about manias. I think these are all very, very useful books. A guy named Sobel wrote a book on the Big Board, which is a history of the New York Stock Exchange. He's gone over a lot of periods. I like history books. And then Marty Zweig had Winning on Wall Street and Norman Foss, Market Logic, and those would be some of my favorites.
What do you read to relax? Do you read anything that's not technical analysis, markets, or history?
You know, I read, I like sports. I read about sports. I don't like to discuss politics, but I like politics. So I read like that's gotten more and more fascinating. Mm-hmm. And some other fiction, I really don't read a lot. I read just recently, my kids maybe read a Boys in the Boat, which is a story of rowing and Washington State that went on and won the Olympics, it was a fascinating book.
Quite interesting. So tell us what's changed since you joined the industry. What do you think are the most significant shifts that we've witnessed over the past few decades?
Well, it's the same thing anybody would know. We've gone from, you know, drawing with paper and pen and
were you doing that earlier in your career?
Absolutely.
Everybody I've spoken, Alan Shaw, Ralph Acampora, they all tell about charting by hand. What does that do for you?
Well, not only that, I had a big wall in my office. Basically, my wallpaper were charts that I put up and marked by hand. And now, of course, everything is technology and, I'd say that's the biggest change. And there were a lot more inefficiencies when I started in the business. If you wanted to study market inefficiencies, you could find them. And with algorithms and computers and all these bright guys doing this stuff, I think there's a lot less of that. So from that standpoint, I think the business has gotten a lot tougher. And you have to be flexible and you have to adjust, because it's changing all the time.
When you were charting by hand versus doing it today, where you just push a button on a computer, do you lose anything in the process of not day by day spending 45 minutes putting together however many hundred charts you were doing by hand each day? What's lost when that goes away?
I guess there's some kind of feel, but if you go through enough charts, I think you get the same kind of feel. So no, I don't think I've lost much from that.
So given that technology has been the prime driver of changes in the past, what do you think the next major shifts are going to be in the industry?
Well, here's the thing, you know, in every age, there's something that comes along that catches people's narrative, and what you want to do is be in a position that when that changes, that you can take advantage of it. And you'll read rules. I have rules, and I teach rules and philosophy. But again, if they get too popular, they quit working. And so that's what makes this a fascinating business. It makes it so difficult to forecast. Alan Abelson had this line one time, and I loved it. He said, just about the time you learn how to play the game, they change the rules. So I think there's a lot of truth in that. And so I think, what we need to do is stay flexible, disciplined, and go against whatever gets overly done.
Professor Andrew Lowe at MIT called it adaptive markets. No matter what the circumstances are, eventually markets adapt to it, and those rules stop working. Tell us about a time you failed and what you learned from it. What was something where, gee, that didn't work out as expected? What was the takeaway?
Well, I said one of my rules is don't fight the Fed. Well, the Fed was tightening right into to 2000 and into 2007, and as soon as as Bear Stearns blew up, they started easing. Mm-hmm. So you say, well, the market can't go down because the Fed's going to protect it. And that's one of my key rules. Well, the Fed kept easing and the market kept going down. So I didn't, this is not a mistake, because I saw the trend turning down, and I saw the sentiment where it was with the housing bubble. So that didn't throw me off. But in the late 1990s, one of Gould's indicators was the dividend yield on the Dow. And he said, when it gets down below, 3%, the market's in trouble. Well, it did that in late 1996. And that, I think that's one of the reasons, the Greenspan said irrational exuberance, but the market kept going up. So that was an indicator that I think had never failed, and it failed in that case. And it got me too cautious too soon.
So what do you do outside of the office to keep either mentally or physically fit? What do you do to relax?
Well, I try to work out. We actually have a gym at our office, and so I try to do that. I play a little golf, and then we live on the west coast of Florida, and we do quite a bit of boating. Mm-hmm. My younger boys are both big fishermen, so I pretty much have to have to get out on the water. Don't fish.
You're on the Gulf side. Oh, so I was going to say, they're looking for tarpon and bonefish and what else. Do you ever go with them fishing?
Mm-hmm. Well, sometimes, yeah.
What are they typically fishing
for? Yeah, tarpon's one of the favorites, but mm-hmm. we're a grouper and snapper area. We got some really good fish.
All edible, eat what you catch and release the rest?
We release everything that's not good eating, for sure.
What sort of advice would you give to a millennial or a recent college graduate who's just beginning their career in markets or interested in technical analysis? How would you advise them?
Well, I got into this business at the beginning of an incredible bull market. So I would say, I've had a lot of luck from a timing standpoint, but I could have quit this business a long time ago, and I continue to work. And the reason is because I love it. And what I love about it is that 1 year it's energy that's driving the stock market. And the next year it's housing. So I got to be a housing expert. And the next year it's geopolitical. And it's just always changing. So I'm a person that loves to learn. The world's changing. And it's fascinating. I can get an education, a new education every year, and I get paid well to do it. And the markets are fascinating. And, to go into an industry, let's say you go into the steel industry and you're stuck there for 40 or 50 years. I mean, I'm in a different industry, or there's a different industry, technology, whatever, that's driving the market every year. So I think it's a fascinating business. I think people should go in it. And, I love it.
And our final question, what do you know about technical analysis and markets today that you wish you knew back in the late early 70s when you first started?
Well, as I said earlier, I started out as a forecaster, and I think that's a good way to lose money and be wrong. So So that's one thing. I would have gotten into that earlier, obviously. And I do think when you look at charts, just as the pure technician, a lot of times you see what you want to see. And so I think you've got to try to quantify it as much as possible. So
how closely have you followed the field of behavioral economics as it's developed over the past, let's call it 30, 35 years? Because a lot of what you reference on the technical side very much tracks what the guys like Danny Kahneman and Bob Shiller and Richard Thaler have been saying for quite a while.
You know, there's a lot, like I said, there's a lot of good ideas out there. I think, though, if you don't put it in a big macro context, if you just take one area and you focus on it, then that's a mistake. So you got to put it in context. For example, right now, I'm a huge fan of the Laffer curve. Mm-hmm. And Kennedy did it, and it worked wonderfully. He cut rates from 91 to 70. Reagan came in, he cut them from 70 to 50, then he cut them from 50 to 28. We had a boom in the 60s, we had a boom in the 80s. Great idea, right? Well, then George Bush tried it in 2000. Didn't work. And because we were in a different phase of the cycle. So when you have a rule, mm-hmm. and everybody's got a rule, a Keynesian rule, yes, there was a good reason for deficits and bailouts at one point, mm-hmm. right? But it doesn't work at another point in time. So I think this is the problem with this kind of thing, just getting focused on one area. You've got to put it in context.
Let me push back on the Laffer rule for a second. When you have very high taxes and you cut them significantly, you get a huge impact from
right,
that.
Right, exactly.
When you make minor changes, what did Bush do, 39 exactly what, to 37?
Exactly what Trump wants to do, 39 to 35, exactly.
Remember, when Reagan came in, there were all manner of tax shelters and deferments. His tax change immediately led to a whole range of behavioral changes. Accountants, lawyers, investors, hey, this real estate shelter you have, it's done. You better move your money elsewhere. And a lot of it finds its way into, but 3-4%, nobody is doing a wholesale revision of it.
It's an incentive, but it's very small. You ask people, if you drop your next dollar from 91 to 70,
right,
would that make you want to work harder?
Hell yeah.
And then you say, what about if you went from 39 to 35? They went,
not really. I'll take the extra cash, but I'm certainly not changing my entire corporate structure.
Kennedy did it after two recessions, mm-hmm. 58 and 60, and Reagan did it after two recessions, 80 and 82.
Right.
And now we've had a 9-year expansion, and we're going to stimulate
by
cutting taxes. So I just say there's nothing wrong with the rule. There's
it's
nothing
how it's
wrong
applied.
With the incentives, but it depends on when it happens, what era, what the cycle is. So that's the problem with having a set mindset.
You referenced your following politics from afar. Who else do you think has some interesting political theories as to what's going on these days?
There was a commission that, and I think this was Obama's really biggest mistake, but anyway, he had a commission to look at the fiscal monetary structure, mm-hmm. Simpson-Bowles, and it was bipartisan, mm-hmm. last bipartisan commission we've had, and nobody liked it because somebody was getting gored somewhere, was getting something taken away, but I personally felt like that was a great idea. And neither the Democrats nor Republicans would do it. But I think essentially that was a lot of the things we needed to do.
We have been speaking to Ned Davis of Ned Davis Research. If you enjoy this conversation, be sure and check out our other past 3 years. I don't even know how many we've had of conversations. I would be remiss if I did not thank Taylor Riggs, my Booker producer, and Michael Batnick, our head of research. Be sure and check out all our other conversations. You can find them on SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, Apple, iTunes. We love your comments, feedback, and suggestions. Write to us at MIBpodcast@Bloomberg.net. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
Our world is always moving. So with Merrill Lynch, you can get access to financial guidance online, in person, or through the app. Visit ml.com and learn more about Merrill Lynch, an affiliate of Bank of America. Merrill Lynch makes available products and services offered by Merrill Lynch, Pierce Fenner & Smith Incorporated, a registered broker-dealer member SIPC.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.